tech stocks and the NASDAQ whipsaw into a stunning reversal. U.S. Treasuries continue their march higher on the week. What does the jobs report mean for the economy and the rotation trade? Welcome, Ed. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you very much.
Busy Friday, busy week. Let's jump right in. Ed, what's on your mind?
Yeah, you know, a lot to recap for this week. You know, I'm thinking most about the interviews that I've had as well as the market action. Two or three interviews that come to mind. One from last week, which was on RVDB. I spoke to Jim Bianco. I'm thinking a lot about that. I also had another interview this week on RVDB with Peter Buchvar. And I think that those two were good enough as individual interviews that I want to put those two together. Hopefully we can get something organized and have me talking to both of them next week. Also, we had an interview with Leland Miller on China. I'm thinking about that just from a just broader sense. But earlier in the day, I spoke to Andreas Stenner Larsen from Nordea, and he had a lot of interesting things to say. So that's what's on my mind. And if I could frame it all from a macro perspective, it's about the reflation trade, inflation. It's about currencies and bond markets. That's the generic gist of all of those interviews and what's happening in the markets that I'm thinking about.
Yeah, let me read my favorite quote of the day from Ed Harrison's Credit Write-Downs, talking exactly about that point, fixed income. Quote, "We are now set to consolidate above the 1.5 resistance level that represents the next move up in the stair-step climb of rates for the U.S. 10-year Treasury. If we close above that level today and next Friday, consider the next level of resistance much higher, i.e. 1.75 or 200 basis points. And then you go on to say, and Fed Chair Powell confirmed what I've been telling you about this. The Fed is reactive, not proactive. It won't put in a Fed put until something breaks. So punters can forget about the Fed saving the day until we see some serious market carnage."
Yeah. You know, I think this goes into where Jack's headed. When I think about serious market carnage, first and foremost, I'm thinking about credit markets. And, you know, since Jerome Powell is a PE guy, private equity, he's thinking about those credit spreads as well. And so, you know, Jack, he's looking at the credit markets. He's looking at the absolute levels, duration, et cetera. The thing that I'm looking at the most is the fact that credit spreads actually have not come down, that even though we're seeing a tightening of credit conditions in general, U.S. investment grade corporate bond spreads have actually narrowed to 92 basis points from 96 basis points at the end of last year. They're down 4.2% on a total return basis. That's just because treasuries have gone up, but the spreads themselves have narrowed. If I say is true, then eventually we should see some spread widening and we should see some pain in credit markets.
Yeah, you know, just to put an exclamation point under that, IG corporate bonds down, LQD, that's the iShares investment grade bond ETF out of BlackRock, of course, looks like it's down 6.5% since its DEC 31 high. Bank of America out with a note yesterday cutting IG to underweight.
Yeah, so Jack, give us your read on this situation, which I think is different enough from how I'm reading it as well.
Yeah, Ed, I think both of you make good points. Like you said, Ash, LQD is down, investment grade, that ETF is down, TLT down much, much more because it bears the greatest interest rate risk. In other words, it's has the most exposure to when interest rate rises, it will go down the most. Meanwhile, right, you have HYG or the high yield ETF, and we all know that has a lot of credit risk. However, it has relatively a small amount of interest rate risk relative to something like LQD or TLT. LQD has a duration, an average duration of about 7 years. High yield has a duration half that. So the average time at which the bonds end and they are paid back is much, much shorter than something like LQD. Meanwhile, TLT, as you both know, that's full of treasury bonds that have a maturity longer than 20 years out. So with TLT, you have a lot of interest rate risk, but no credit rate risk. And I'm just looking at the high yield bond market now, and I'm seeing a lot of players come to the market who haven't come there before. Twilio announced this week that they're going to price $1 billion worth of bonds. And that's the first time that they visited the junk market. Previously, they've raised capital exclusively through convertible bonds. So I think there's kind of this sense in the world of these technology names, let's say, who say, like, let's get in on the high yield bonanza while it's still good. So that's my general outlook. And that also plays to the technology sector, which is absolutely dumping like crazy because interest rates are rising. So there's a lot there.
You know, let me just add, because I know some of our subscribers have pointed out to us that some of this stuff, when we get into the weeds on the bond side, on the fixed income side, we sometimes gloss over some of these key points. The duration that you're talking about in fixed income is the amount of time it takes to pay off the purchase price of the bond from the internal cash flows. It also is a measure of sensitivity in price change relative to interest rate risk. This is a critical distinction for understanding the bond market, which you've been so good at covering and bringing out some of these more nuanced points in.
Yeah. And also, by the way, I think that's a good explanation. I would go one step further and say that when you're talking about duration, you're talking about the average payment length. That is that if you think about a bond as a coupon payment over a period of time and then a balloon payment at the end, you take all of those flows and then come out with the average of when you get half of your money back. That's the duration of the bond. So if bond rates go down, let's say they go down towards 0%, then the duration goes up towards almost the exact tail end of when you get the balloon payment. A zero coupon bond's duration is actually coincident with the duration of the bond. Right. But as interest rates go up, much more of the bond is in the front of the bond in terms of the coupon payments that you're getting up front.
Right. And higher coupon rates, all else being equal, lower duration because you get higher cash flows coming in. Longer date to maturity remaining, also higher.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, if you're a bond investor, everyone's talking about duration. You know, duration matching is where it's at. You know, we're talking about insurance companies. We're talking about also life insurance companies and pension plans. They want to match assets and liabilities. So right. The higher the yields go, the shorter the duration of the assets they're buying. And so ultimately, you know, in some ways, actually, it puts pressure at the long end of the market for you to want more duration because you're not getting that. And so there are a lot of different dynamics that are at play in the bond market. So it's quite interesting.
Yeah. And of course, that makes sense. If you think about what a pension fund does, you have liabilities in terms of outflows that you need to pay out, and you're trying to match them with income that you're generating from your fixed income portfolio.
Yeah. And, you know, I think where Jack is he's talking about a time frame over which we're going to see with this stair step up in terms of rates, we're going to see duration be the thing that matters. So duration matters the most, the long end of the treasury curve, because there's no credit risk there, and that's where the longest durations are. Then you move to LQD, and you see that durations are shorter, and there also is some credit risk associated there. And then more credit risk, but even shorter duration in the junk bond market, so JNK and other ETFs there. But what I would say is eventually this is going to flip, where it's not just going to be about duration. It's going to be much more about credit. So to the degree that you're thinking of a different time frame, that's what you should be thinking about. I spoke to Andreo Stena Larsson earlier today, and his view is that, you know, starting in 2022, we will be thinking much more about the downside risk. Actually, already this year, we should be thinking about the downside risk to the degree that the market is forward looking, but the downside risk are going to crystallize by that particular time. So we're throwing a lot of logs into the fire, to you know, goose up the market, goose up GDP growth, but eventually that's going to come unstuck, according to him. And if that's true, then we're going to see that reflected in credit spreads.
Yeah, just to highlight one of the fundamental points that you just made there, credit risk has not been part of the story because of the Fed extending liquidity and also because of fiscal stimulus. Now, that's why you're seeing those tights on spreads, but that could change, as you point out, as credit risks begin to unwind or grow.
Exactly. So that's where I am in this whole situation.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah. Can we turn the story a little bit to equities? Because I think that you had some pretty intense price action today. Tesla sold off. All the growth stocks sold off tremendously, like they have been this week. Again, of course, that's related to rising rates because tech stocks have essentially a very long duration as well. They're growth stocks. But then we had a little bit of a volta within the day, and somewhere around 11:30, things changed, and the market really went up, and those growth stocks went right with them. And I'm looking at a chart now of Tesla and the ARK ETF, which owns a lot of Tesla shares. In fact, it comprises a great deal of their net asset value, yeah. And they absolutely fit like a glove. And I'm also looking at Norwegian Cruise Liners, which that's another thing I want to bring up. You think you hear today, oh my God, it was the tech stocks that dumped, because that is the narrative that you've been hearing. That's what we've been seeing. However, the top three stocks that were down the most, as I took a screenshot about 2:30 p.m., were cruise liners. It was Norwegian Cruise Liners, Royal Caribbean Cruise Liners, and I think it's because these companies are raising equity. They continue to raise equity because they need cash. And it makes me think of what one of my economics professors said, which is good companies raise debt, bad companies raise equity. Because when you raise equity, you dilute the other shareholders. And it's not what you want to do. It's basically a reverse stock buyback. RCL, NCLH, CCL, American Airlines, Live Nation Entertainment, basically all of these reopening stocks, which you think would be booming since we have these extremely high expectations for growth and inflation, right. they were dumping. So I think you're seeing the fundamentals just leak into the market because, look, if you have to issue more shares to get money and secure financing, then that's going to drive down the stock price.
Yeah, just some hard data points here. I'm not following the cruise lines as closely as you are, Jack, but I was looking at ARK and Tesla, both of which peaked within about 3 weeks of each other. 12 February on ARK, 156. Today, last I saw, 115, off 26.3% from peak. Tesla, Jan 26 peak, 883. Now, last trade, I saw 587, off 33.5%. So losing a third of its value from peak.
Yeah, so I think one of the questions that we should be asking ourselves is the rotation as a result of the reopening over? Is the reopening trade done? This whole reflation trade, and now we have to be thinking about what happens next. I mean, mentally, I'm already moving on to what happens once we get to the reopening. And it sounds to me like the market is digesting it in that favor. I'll give you an example because I spoke to Chris Whalen, I believe it was yesterday. That's an interview that's going to come out next Thursday. We were talking about banks. And if you take a look at the bank ETF, which is XLF, that's up to 33.64 last I checked. You know, that will be a 52-week high for the bank stocks. I looked at two banks that I look at, which are Fifth Third and Danske Bank, one in the United States, one over in Europe. Both of those hit 52-week highs. I got alerts for those today. To me, that's part and parcel of this whole rotation into the reopening, the same sort of rotation that we're seeing that's affecting the likes of Carnival Cruises and Norwegian and so forth. To me, also, that's overdone now, that the levels, the amount of rotation that we've seen, the uptick in the financials is overplayed. After speaking to Chris, what he's talking about in particular is that, you know, as we move towards the latter half of the year, what we're going to see is an increasing problem with regard to commercial real estate. So when we think about, okay, so now we've gotten the rotation into the reopening play, what happens next? That's when you start thinking about commercial real estate. That's when you start thinking about what happens when Jack, Ed, and Ash, who used to actually work in the same building together a year ago, are in a position to do so again. Are they going to do it? You know, and if they aren't going to do it, what does it mean for bank balance sheets? I think that's what we, what people are starting to think. That a lot of the stuff that is stay at home is going to do better at the margin relative to the old normal, the pre-pandemic normal. So right. Yeah. I think it's all been priced in.
And if you want a chart to take a look at there, we were looking at earlier, XLE priced in XLK. This is basically energy priced in tech. This is the Spider Select sector out of State Street. You look at that chart, you can see loses about almost 60% of its value.
Yeah, definitely. There's so much to say, Ash. That's such a good point. There's so many metrics that capture these reflation trade. One thing I have my eye on is TLT to SPY, or long bonds relative to the S&P 500 or the ETF that tracks that. And that likewise too, it pretty much matches the XLE to XLK. People are piling in to risk on trades, and they're piling out of defensive sectors like tech, like utility, and then the ultimate defensive sector, which is bonds. Ed, I'm so glad that you brought up XLF, because if I recall, I think that XLF, I think of it as having a ton of traditional brick and mortar banks. It's very conservative. I think the largest holding is Berkshire Hathaway, something like 11-12%. It doesn't have your PayPals. It doesn't have your MasterCards. It's sort of companies that I would place like in between banks and crypto in terms of financial innovation. So because it doesn't have that, the stock continues to do well because it's the PayPals and the sort of growth stocks that are getting pummeled. So I think XLF is a perfect encapsulation of your brick and mortar banks that are doing well. The market's not pricing in credit risk. The market expects rates to continue to rise. That will be phenomenal for banks because they borrow short and lend long. So I think the reopening trade is dead. And I think you look at not just commercial real estate, but you look at the cruise liners. They're literally having to issue shares to survive. Movie theaters, I think, open tomorrow or very early next week, which, you know, I'm excited for. I'm not going to do it for safety reasons, but I think it's great. AMC has had to issue a ton of equity in order to survive as well. So these reopening stocks, they basically have to continue to issue debt and equity to survive. So I think we're going to see something interesting going forward with that.
Yeah. And this is where the market's pricing it in. They're saying at the margin, there are going to be changes that are happening. And, you know, let me say that those changes that are happening are actually happening in the jobs numbers that we looked at. When I think about it, just from a purely economic perspective, I was looking at the last print that we had for non-farm payrolls, which came out today. We had a really good number, you know, almost 400,000. When you added in the upward revisions from the previous year, from the previous month, it was above 500,000 jobs. Great. But actually, more than 300,000 of those jobs came from the leisure and hospitality sectors, which are really the toggle at this point in time. Those are the ones that when we lock down, you see massive cuts. And then when we open it back up, you see massive gains. If you looked at the other sectors right. of the economy, they're really not growing quite as much. So to me, what we're seeing now is that's the one overlay that we should be thinking of. The second is that underneath it all, where you see all those sectors where it's not growing as much, they're massive, massive job layoffs as well as job gains. There's just this this churn as people try to figure out what do they do from their business perspective to deal with this new normal. Here's a statistic that I don't think enough people talk about. Every single print in the initial jobless claim series since we went into lockdown a year ago has been higher than the highest print that we ever got in all the previous data prints going back to 1967. So the jobless claim series is a series that goes back to 1967. And if you look at that series, every single number that has come out since we went into lockdown is higher than the highest number of all the previous prints that we had before. That tells you that even a year after we've had all of this carnage, it's still going on. We're still trying to figure out what the new economy looks like. And I think that churning is going to be negative in terms of GDP growth at the margin. So once you remove the government from the picture, the government largesse, you're still going to have some problems.
And that's just fascinating. That's really interesting analysis. And that's just a function of that steep first leg down on the V and also obviously of population growth. But really interesting stuff, Ed. It almost sounds like it's effectively what's happening is the services sector jobs are becoming the swing player in this particular data series. Now, historically, for those of us who've been following macro for a long time, that was typically in manufacturing sector jobs. But now, because of the lockdown and the impact that we saw from that, it's now about seeing, you know, who wants to go out and who needs to staff up those positions in the services sector in order to meet that demand.
Right. Yeah. And so, I mean, the primary trend is that first tick down, the V up, and then sort of a rollover, you know, that's the reverse radical recovery that people are talking about. But that rollover is happening sort of in a very bumpy way, just because we're have a start stop, lockdown, no lockdown type of economy. But the trend is definitely not as robust as it was during the initial V. And as you say, the trigger or the toggle is in the services sector now much more than the manufacturing sector. And that's in part because we're still trying to figure out what the new services economy looks like. I mean, if you asked me, I would say the new services economy looks like I want to stay at home at the margin slightly more than I did before. So if you took 100 people and you polled them and said, what are you going to do relative to what you did before the pandemic? I would say that you would get a good 10%, you know, 5% of them who would say, I'm going to do less of the things I used to do before and more of the things that I've been doing since the pandemic. So at the margin, all the businesses that Jack was talking about, those are going to be hit. And so is that priced in now that we've had the reopening trade, or are we going to see another leg down in those shares as we did when they first got hit back in March 2020?
Let me just give you the data points for those who aren't following this series as closely as Ed. So it's 379,000 new jobs added in February. January revised up to 166,000. So you see that acceleration there in the rates. As Ed pointed out, that's about 550,000 new jobs added year to date in the last 2 months. But let's take a look at the unemployment rate numbers. Unemployment rate now down to 6.2%. That's off the pandemic high of 14.8%. And while that's obviously a significant improvement, more than cut in half, it wasn't that long ago, Ed and Jack, where we were celebrating the unemployment rate going below 5%. So this is still an elevated rate. And in addition to that, you also have folks who have left the labor market and are no longer getting counted in that figure.
Yeah, I was waiting for Jack to get in there, but I know he thinks that employment's in what my wheelhouse, so it's on me to talk about that. Yeah, I think that the Fed, they're onto that. They know that that 6.2% number, that's not a real number that's comparable to the numbers that we had before the pandemic. And so this is one reason that their policy is the way that it is. The real question is whether or not they can get away with it. You know, given what's happening elsewhere in terms of inflation, bottlenecks in the supply chains, commodity prices going way up, the market is basically front running the Fed in terms of the need to pull forward their timetable on normalizing interest rates. We'll see who wins that battle. But I think, as I said earlier in the conversation, that Jay Powell basically told us that he's just going to wait for breakage before he submits. He's going to let the bond market do whatever it wants to do. And if it leads to breakage, only then is he going to step in. So you got to beware if you think that the Fed put is going to save you.
Mm. Yeah, and that's a good point. I'm cracking a smirk because I watched Fed Powell's discussion with that Wall Street Journal reporter, and the Wall Street Journal said, what did you make of rising rates? And what Fed Powell said was, it was notable. And I'm like, yeah, I bet you noticed it. but Ed, so you have a nuanced perspective you just laid out on why you think the reflation trade could be a little bit overdone. I just had an interview with Teddy Valley, who thinks rates will continue to rise and that growth could be as high as 12%. So I'm influenced by that. So I have a slightly different view, but I'm not so interested as much in my view or explaining my view as perhaps exploring the possibility that, Ed, you think that COVID will continue to be a very big deal, that these lasting trends, people will work from home, yada, yada, yada. I'll say for argument's sake that I think the exact opposite. I think that people are going to rush into the office. People are going to go to all the bars. And, you know, there's a picture out of this advertisement where it's talking about the new normal. And it's this man and woman kissing each other in this rather way that shows that they're not being careful. It's the new normal, basically saying it's the summer is here. Like, let's go out. So let's say that you're right, Ed. I actually think the S&P is going to be higher if you're right and lower if I'm right, because I think that these reflation trades, the market cap is just so small. Like, I'm looking at the S&P 500 energy market cap is only 2.7% of the S&P. Its bottom in late 2020 was 1.8%. So Apple right now is about 2.5 to 3 times larger than the entire energy sector. So I think if Apple does poorly, that's going to drag down the entire market a lot more than the S&P 500. Like, energy can only go so high, no matter how much of a mean reversionist you are. So I think that it's intellectually consistent to be a reflationist and believe in reflation and actually be more bearish than someone who has the worst possible expectations about reopening.
Well, I am a reflationist. I think that there is going to be pent up demand. I think that, you know, we're seeing a pop already, you know, so when Teddy Valley talks about 12%, the Atlanta Fed's GDP now tracker is already tracking at 10%. And this is before reopening for Q1. You know, we already have PIMCO talking about full year 2021 at 7%. And so to the degree that places like Texas and Mississippi are opening up fully already, and then we're all going to be vaccinated fairly shortly, you know, people are going to be partying in the streets to a certain degree. But I think that the market has already discounted that. The market said that that's what's going to happen. Everyone has piled into that trade. They think that's going to happen. And so now we're quickly approaching the point when people are like, okay, we know that's going to happen. What happens next? And that's the great unknown. The unknown is what happens after we get the pop. And we don't even know how long that pop is going to be. Let's say it's 3 months. What happens next? And to my view, that's where the new normal comes into play. And I believe that new normal is going to be somewhat more weighted toward the pandemic than it, you know, there's a slight move towards the pandemic lifestyle, if you will. Let's say it's 10% towards that lifestyle instead of 100%. But at the margin, that matters in terms of, you know, your mix of companies. And then your question is that priced in? That's the same question that I have.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Yeah, you know, talking reflation and rotation, we don't know what's going to happen in the future, but we do know what's happened in the past. NASDAQ 100 down 3 weeks in a row, erasing $1.6 trillion in market cap from those 100 stocks alone. NASDAQ 100 returned 50% in 2020.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting, I must say, is the price action as we're speaking. The market is getting towards a close as we're speaking. You know, the Dow's up 600 points, that's 2%. NASDAQ's up 1.5%. You know, I think the NASDAQ was down 2% when we were preparing for this earlier in the day. And I'm looking at the buys. Tesla just flipped from a neutral to a strong buy on my screen. Apple, Alphabet, Amazon, NVIDIA, actually not NVIDIA, but Facebook and Alibaba are all strong buys, and NVIDIA is a buy. So that tells you suddenly, you know, momentum investors, they're just piling into that trade. So this whole back and forth is not over by any stretch of the imagination. I would say that I still believe the toggle is rates, duration, as Jack puts it, because at the end of the day, it's the 10-year that is coming down, the 5-year coming down, that is the question for the markets. One last thing on this. I was talking to Andreo Steno Larsson about this earlier today. To me, it's the 3 to 5 year rate, the belly of the curve. That's what we're talking about. If you look at overnight rates, 3-month rates, 2-year rates, they're basically unmoved over the last several months. It's really when you start to get to 3 and then later to 5, that's where you see the massive move. That's where we're thinking about the duration risk starting to play out. And that's where people are starting to talk to the Fed about whether or not the Fed's behind the curve.
By the way, talking about risk and not over yet, obviously, we've been following the numbers very closely on COVID. Current hospitalizations down dramatically, daily deaths down dramatically, daily case count down dramatically, but also news in the last 48 hours, France and Japan are locking down further or extending lockdowns that were set to expire. And Germany has instituted a limit on French travel, even within the Schengen area. So still some things to cards to play out there in this crisis.
Yeah, I don't know if you have anything to say on that, Jack, but yeah, the light at the end of the tunnel's there. It's still somewhat unclear how long that tunnel's going to be.
Yeah, and it's a dark tunnel, even though we can see the light at the end of it.
It is a dark tunnel. Sorry to be Mr. Silent. I just have some. Most of what I have is focused on equities, and particularly like data on growth companies. So I did a thread on Twitter. I think it was last night. I was just looking. And it wasn't a scientific, you know, analysis, but I was just looking at the companies that were down the most. What were their price to sales ratios? And, you know, it was companies like Luminar that had a price to sales ratio over 100. A company like Microvision, which, you know, if you're following markets in the dot-com bubble, I think that was one of the darlings of the dot-com bubble. It's LiDAR technology. So what I said, was that it's been the future of 3D imaging technology, and it has been for 30 years. And that company has a price to sales ratio over 200. And then there's the king of price to sales multiple, which, by the way, price to sales multiple is just the market cap relative to the revenue. Is Virgin Galactic. So the market cap is now $6 billion. It's down over 50% from its peak of about $14 billion when the stock was in the high 50s. So Ed and Ash, guess, so peak valuation, $14 billion. Guess how much revenue Virgin Galactic had in 2020?
Guessing not a lot.
$100,000.
It beat me to it, but $238,000. So a tremendous... Yeah,
I want to know where they made 238 grand. Was it like selling concessions or something? Or where does that come from?
Good question. I mean, to be fair, their 2019 revenue was in the neighborhood of 3.7 million. So obviously the pandemic impacted them. I also want to draw attention to, so they've had this massive dump. On Tuesday and Wednesday, Chamath Palihapitiya, notable investor, been called the king of SPACs, he sold about, I think, 15.8 million shares of it actually could have been 12 million, but it was a position valued at over $200 million. So him exiting this position, that says, you know, he's not thinking so hot on the stock anymore. And then
his position went to zero. Is that right?
That's what's disclosed in the file. You know, he could have something on E-Trade on the side that we don't know about. But yeah, the filing said he's zero. He's completely out of the trade. That's what the file said. I also have a few things to say about SPACs. So Virgin Galactic is a SPAC. So I've got some more fun little data. You guys ready for this?
Yeah, I'm absolutely really thinking about Chamath and whether or not, you know, what his real position is, because he's taken a lot of stick for being involved in the space in the way that he has, and, you know, the K-shaped recovery and all that kind of stuff. So I wonder if this has anything to do with that.
Yes, he is a growth investor. I think he's said publicly, you know, I would not own an enterprise stock. I wouldn't own a dollar worth of a bank stock. He's definitely someone who's focused on the growth, focused on the future. And over the past decade, that's been a rainmaker of a trade. I put him in the same category of Cathie Wood, of you know, kind of a visionary. However, this is a very bad time. When rates are rising, it's bad to be a visionary. You want to be an oil baron. But okay, so for SPACs. So roughly, there are about 734 SPACs. That's what I found in my Bloomberg terminal. A lot of those are actually SPACs that are, you know, they've been around for 5 years, and they are now trading at like $5 or even 10 cents on the dollar, trading for 10 cents. And remember, every SPAC starts at $10. So for that, you know, it's kind of the graveyard of SPACs. But let's just take the stocks that have the SPACs which have IPO'd over the past 2 years. There are 282 of them. Again, this is what my data says, that have IPO'd since March 5th of 2019. Of those 282, there were 36 that were trading for less than $10 3 months ago. So that's less than, you know, the SPAC line is, it can never go less than $10, because if they don't consummate a deal, they just give you back $10. But so 3 months ago, there were 36 out of 282 that were trading for less than a dollar. A week ago, 42 of them were trading below $10. Yesterday, there were 60. Today, there are 64. So the SPAC empire is kind of crumbling. And if you look at the actual performance of the SPAC, so, you know, there still are those high flyers, which if you bought at $10, you're up 200, 300, 400, 500%. But those high flyers have taken a cut as well. So I think there's almost no greater space than the SPAC that has taken it most on the chin during this reflation rate rise timing.
You know, Jack, you're saying basically what I was saying. I'm exactly on your page on all of that. I'm actually thinking of it also in terms of, this is a sign of people moving to the next level. It's that the reflation trade has really played itself out. Now the market is thinking about what happens next. What happens after we do the reopening? The reflation has been baked into the cake. This is yet another sign that that's true. And so I think that the market is now trading on the reopening and what comes next after.
Yeah. This has been an extraordinarily data-rich Real Vision Daily Briefing, and I think we've run way over time. Jack, Ed, final thoughts.
Hey, I'm excited to see if this thesis holds out, that we're past this rotation and we're now moving into the next level. The market is forward-looking, and it's saying that, okay, let's forget about the reflation. Let's think about you know, the reopening and the new normal.
I'm thinking a lot along the lines of Ed, but just to throw something out there at the end, perhaps to the viewer, the curious viewer, the ambitious viewer, look up the implied volatility of options for ARK, the main fund, ARKK, and then look up the implied volatility for the constituents of the fund. You'll find that ARKK implied volatility is actually much lower, despite the fact that the stocks all sort of trade in a bit. And I think that's the reasoning for that is, oh, it's diversified, in the same way that, sure, we've got a CEO that has these really toxic loans in them, but they're diversified. So I'm seeing a little parallel there. Of course, a tremendous amount of respect for Cathie Wood. I just think that growth stocks are going to have a hard couple months, if not year, going ahead.
Yeah, and when you're done looking up volatility spreads, pour yourself a cocktail. It's Friday night.
Definitely.
Excellent.
Thanks for joining us, Jack and Ed. Thanks for watching, everyone.